A Wednesday Evening Lenten Sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on April 2, 2003, entitled, Why Jesus in a World of Religion? Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
The question this evening, why Jesus in a world of religions? I suspect I'm preaching to the choir tonight, and I haven't got anything to say that I haven't said here a couple of dozen times, I suppose. And yet, as I have been doing some preparation for the coming of Dr. Charles Kimball the weekend after Easter, who will lead us in our thinking about the question of religion, particularly when religion becomes evil. And I have gone through his book and read again what he sets forth as the five warning signs of when a religion is on the way to becoming evil. I recognize in the context of our present moment in history how necessary it is for us to continue to be clear about the place of religion in human life and the relationship between the religions. And even though it's somewhat old hat here, and it has been my understanding for, a dozen or more years that our Christian faith is not the exclusive, has not the exclusive claim to God's revealed truth or God's grace. Nonetheless, I continue to encounter those for whom that realization is important and continues to be a source of freedom and liberation. Just yesterday I was with a young man. Well, he's not so young, except at my age everybody seems young. But he had called and asked if I would stop and meet with him. I had been in touch with him a year and more ago, as he was going through personal crisis. He was nearly damaged to death by bad religion and has found a wonderful freedom. And yesterday, as I sat with him, he gave witness to the fact that he has found such liberation in his being able to look at others who have a different understanding than he does and not see them as alien or as a threat or as someone on the outside, but rather as fellow human beings on pilgrimage with him. And I could see in his face that joy that he had found. And as he expressed to me being a part of a recovery community, coming in contact with people from all different backgrounds and different faith persuasions and no faith persuasions, and yet in that group seeing the grace of God in others, he spoke of what a joy it was, and again, what a liberation that was for him. And then he looked across the booth at me, and he said, I just wanted to tell you that. And it made me think again about my own experience, because I know so deeply within that freedom and that liberation that comes from being able to have one's feet placed down, but not drawing a circle around in order to exclude, but rather to draw the circle big enough to include the other. And as I reflected on that, I was remembering my own journey. It's very hard for me to believe that I didn't always believe that, because it seems so obvious and it seems so simple to me now. But I was reflecting back on an experience, I think it was 1990, in that great cathedral at Chartres outside of Paris. And I remember this wonderful lecturer, Englishman, Malcolm Miller, who opened up that cathedral in such a fascinating way, and who suggested, in what I had never thought of before, that the cathedral was really like the town library, that it was in the cathedral that the people would come, and in the pictures, the stained glass windows, they'd see the stories, the biblical stories, and you could go through the cathedral as he took us through the cathedral, and you could have the whole biblical story portrayed in stained glass. And then I still remember, as I thought to myself, if you always came to sit in the same place, as Nancy does, for example, you'd only get a piece of the story. And then I thought to myself, if you were a particular religious group or faith tradition, and you had access only to one set of windows, and if it wasn't just all the biblical story, but if it was the story of those great faith traditions, but you were always limited to one place, that's the only tradition you would know. And then I still remember how it dawned on me that all of those windows that told stories were dependent upon one transcendent sense of light, because it is only as that light that transcends filters through the window that the stories make any sense. But the light transcends the particular stories. And for me, that was a beautiful parable about how God transcends the respective religious traditions. And as I continued to work at that and think about that, I became a convinced pluralist. Moving from an exclusive position where the Christian faith is the only truth, and moving through an inclusive position which allows that other faith traditions may bring people into the presence of God, but finally when they get there, they know they will have gotten there only through Jesus Christ. To a pluralist position, which simply recognizes that God has been experienced and known truly, and God's grace has been experienced in all of those great traditions. And I don't know much about other faith traditions. I've had enough trying to figure out my own. But the little bit that I do know, that which is witness to in all of those great traditions, is that same thing that I have experienced as a Christian. So I'm a pluralist. And as a pluralist, then, I raise the question, why Jesus? Why Jesus in a world of religions? And what I want to say to you this evening is that for me, it's Jesus more than ever. It is what I see in Jesus that becomes more compelling to me. And the fact that I can grant to other traditions revelation and grace in no way distracts from what I have found in Jesus. Why Jesus in a world of religions? Well, I would be so bold as to say that I believe that Jesus is the embodiment of God. That's a very, very profound claim. That in the Word made flesh, in the humanity of Jesus, that God is embodied. We speak at Christmas time of the incarnation or the enfleshment. And certainly that claim is biblical. For we read a couple of passages this evening. Paul, who is writing earliest of any of the New Testament writers, in reflection on his own experience, his own encounter of that risen one who appeared to him in a blinding light. Paul, however he had worked that all through, was able to say so explicitly and clearly that it is the God who said, "Let light shine out of darkness." In other words, it is the Creator God, or it is simply God, who has shined into our hearts the light of the knowledge of Jesus Christ, or the light of the knowledge of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And John's gospel, to which I return again and again these days, has it so very clear. In the beginning was the Word, or was that divine intention which became flesh. And acknowledging that no one has ever seen God, but that it is the Son, Jesus, who makes God known, or who exegetes God. So that in the humanity of Jesus is the clue to the mystery that is God, that will always be mystery. Mystery not as something not yet solved, but to be solved, but mystery in the sense that it will never be solved for us, because God will always transcend human comprehension. No one has ever seen God, but Jesus has made God known. And then, of course, in the 14th chapter, and I don't think Jesus had that conversation with Philip, frankly. What would you think of Jesus if Jesus had said, "Look at me and you see the Father"? Maybe he did say that, because he could have said that. Philip said, "Show us the Father." John says, "No one has ever seen God." The longing of the human heart is for some clue as to the being and the nature of God, the experience of God. So Philip says, "Just show us the Father and we'll be satisfied." And Jesus said, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father." So certainly, that is the biblical understanding in the New Testament text. And of course, it's the confessional teaching of the church too. The Nicene Creed of 325, clarified or confused, I'm not sure which, in 451 at the Council of Chalcedon, where we have the church coming out of that creedal conflictual period by saying that Jesus is true God and true man. And the church pretty much rested with it there. And I can understand, if you really want to delve into that history of that creedal development, you can understand how they got there. If you have in the New Testament text such claims as, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father, or we've seen the light of the knowledge of God in the face of Jesus Christ, then you can see how the church came at one point to confess that Jesus, this one who had been here, was God. Now, what they did with it philosophically, using the Greek philosophy that was at hand, what they did with it, I can't do that today. My metaphysics, I wouldn't write Nicaea the way they wrote it or Chalcedon the way they wrote it, but I understand what they were trying to say, and what they were trying to say was that God was in Christ. And thank God they said it, because here we are 2,000 years later, still shaped by that tradition. But for me, the studies of late, the more recent studies, which go back a century but have been particularly active in the last decade or two, the studies of the historical Jesus have made Jesus come alive. To see Jesus in the social, political, economic context of his time, to see Jesus as a peasant member of an occupied people in Rome's imperial government, to see Jesus confronting the domination systems, or you could simply say the established order, to see him confronting those and to realize that he was crucified because of that confrontation is to put flesh and blood on him for me. And it is the historical Jesus, frankly, that fascinates me and that causes me to stand in awe. That human life. And then if I take that historical Jesus, which has come to light so much in our own recent times through cross-cultural studies and archaeological digs and all that we know now, knowing more now than had ever been known before of that concrete context of Jesus. If you take that context and that historical figure, and then you try to read that in light of that, those grand creedal claims about Jesus being God, I can do it. I can do it by really hearing what those New Testament writers were saying. They were saying of a human being, God is there. They were saying that infinite mystery that is God has become concrete in that human being. And then I would say that what the church failed to do was to see that that was not once for all and one for all, but that that was the divine intention for all. So that God embodied in the human is God embodied not only in Jesus, but God embodied in the human, in you. and in me. So that Jesus becomes paradigmatic. Jesus becomes the exemplar. That's where they saw it. That's where those Jews who had all of that Mosaic tradition, all of the Torah and all of the prophets and all of the expectation, coming to encounter that one, that's what they saw. That was their insight. That was the revelation that dawned upon them. That was the epiphany in that man. It's God. And then I hear him say, follow me. It's a lot easier to have him the way the Orthodox conservative tradition has had him, as the pre-existent second member of the Trinity, intervening in our history for a period of time, offering his life for the forgiveness of the sin of the world and exiting again. You see, you don't need Jesus for forgiveness. God takes care of that. Read Psalm 51, David out of his anguish, out of the recognition of his failure. Hear him plead, wash me, make me whiter than snow. Or Psalm 130, O Lord, if thou shouldst mark iniquity, who could stand? But there's forgiveness with thee. Forgiveness didn't come with Jesus. The God of Jesus, the God of Israel, is a God full of grace. As I quoted earlier this evening, the God who blots out our sin as a thick cloud, who buries our sin in the depths of the sea, the God who remembers it against us no more. That's God, full of grace. But when God was embodied in a human being, that human being said, follow me. And that I find more and more difficult. Because in this world and life of which we are a part, it's so costly to take that seriously. And to take that seriously is to be confronted with such a gap in our practice. And I don't know how to do it. We are so invested in our way of life. We are so entangled in the world as it is. And yet, there he is. Why Jesus in a world of religions? Because, dear God, if that's the divine intention, as I believe it is, then that claim on my life is ultimate and absolute. And you can find God in other places and through other traditions. I said Sunday, Jesus isn't the only place where the divine has been unveiled. I even suggested if you can't go there because of some alienation or too much baggage or whatever, go to the Dalai Lama. You find all kinds of people in our frenetic society and our consumer society who are finding in the meditations of the Buddhist tradition their peace. But I'll tell you what, I don't know in my admittedly inadequate exposure to other traditions. I don't know of any more compelling claim than the claim of Jesus. And you know, the interesting thing is, I don't even need Jesus, because I've learned it. I've seen it. The story has taken hold of me. Now, how would it have taken hold of me without the story? It's a circular argument, of course, but my point is this. We don't need to flee back to Jesus. We've met him. We've heard him. And the question is, to what extent we will allow the magnificence of that person to elicit from us the highest and the best, the greatest nobility of which the human creature is possible. Why Jesus? I think he's the hope of the world. I see in his vulnerability. And where is he more vulnerable than exposed between heaven and earth on the cross? And that vulnerability is a picture of God. The God who doesn't move like a bulldozer through history with coercion, but beckons us with love and persuasion. And in our world tonight, as we worship, isn't that the great divide? Wherein lies the hope of the world? In order, enforced by power, or in love, working by persuasion. I'm a pluralist. I don't think our tradition has a corner on it all. But I'll tell you what. Jesus is the most compelling and disturbing reality of my life.